Yeah, now it's out. Hey, everybody. Sorry, running a few minutes late. I'm just doing this to show you that we are fighting with deadlines too, and we are all stressed out up the wazoo as well. That goes for your tutors as well. We are all running as fast as we can at the moment. So it's not just you fighting with deadlines. Basically, I'm saying this to show you that we do understand that you have pressure. Okay, it's nothing that comes in any way alien to us on the academic side. So a few housekeeping items. There will be an exam session, mid-semester exam, learning session on Friday, organized by the CSSA. Details are on the forums already. I'm sure they will discuss last year's mid-semester exam in excruciating detail as well. Usually what you do in these sessions is you go through previous exam papers and you're trying to mop up all the loose ends which developed throughout the labs and lectures so far, as we will also try to mop up a few loose ends here in the lecture today. So, a few other housekeeping items. If you have an EAP in this course, you will get extended time for the mid-semester exam according to your EAP. Whether you contacted me or not, doesn't matter. I will do this for all EAP students. As I said, whether they contact me or not doesn't make a difference. So this will automatically be happening. If you are in trouble with the assignment, let us know. We are very happy to help you and to do something about it. Please understand that we cannot take your word for some of these things. So for fairness reasons, we cannot assume that somebody says, well, I'm in stress, I'm in trouble. Give me an extension. We need some evidence that you have had situations which are different from other students. This could be a medical, this could be some other documentation or proof that your situation is different. This is not because we don't want to believe you, but we need to do that. Otherwise, every second student will actually send me an email like that. So please understand that. Okay, and for fairness reasons, I have to uphold these standards. No reason, no other possibility there. Also for the assignment, 80% of the course can now close their ears for a moment. A few of the other students should listen up. Plagiarism is very seriously treated, and yes, we will kick students out of this course for plagiarism if we detect any. Okay? You may even have done that. And there will be serious consequences. If you gained access in any way, shape, or form to code of another student, which is a solution to this assignment, or to a previous assignment of similar nature, if you gained access to that, this is already stepping over the line, okay? So if you accidentally, I assume, gained access to that kind of information at this time, I recommend, and I strongly recommend, you go to your machine, you delete all of this information right now, and you stay away from your assignment for 2 days to forget everything you have read there. Otherwise, you are very close to a plagiarism investigation, and as I said, it's very serious. Don't play with it, okay? So that's just for a little bit of housekeeping. Otherwise, the assignment seems to be tons of fun. I see lots and lots of waveforms of all shapes and forms at the moment. Seems to be all going fine. This lecturing about functions is, by the way, not decorative. Right? So knowing how to do functions is actually kind of good, kind of useful for your assignment, for example. So just take a hint. Functions are extremely useful for any kind of structured programming. What I'm saying is not extremely useful. It is required. You cannot survive without understanding functions in the full. So make sure you actually get your head around it. Also, a little bit of a heads up for the mid-semester exam. So if you read previous mid-semester exam terms, please also note that the courses were a little bit differently structured, some of them. And in this year, 2021, we put a lot of emphasis in any detail of training you in functions straight away. Your functions lab this week has not been that early in previous years. So we put a lot of effort and emphasis on functions. This will be reflected in the mid-semester exam. Okay? So just as a heads up, if you exercise from previous exam papers, which is great, please keep in mind it was a different semester. Right? So we are not just cloning the previous exam papers. Cool. Technical details for the mid-semester exam will follow. Okay? So I will work out how to do that exactly with you for the release of the paper and the resubmission of the whole thing. So, a few questions. I can attend a study session. Will there be a recording of the session? I'll leave this to CSSA to do that. But there is not a universe. This is not a lecture, right? So it doesn't mean that you can actually just listen to another lecture. So being there is actually quite important, but the CSSA might help you a little bit in there. Recording them, it's individual student sessions, so lots and lots of individual ones. There is not that much to record. Well, Sandra, I'll leave it to the CSSA. So, the bar is also a good place to go to forget. I'm sure it is. So, if you need forgetting, as I said, if you accidentally gained access to other students' code, yes, forget. Delete, step away, now. Cool. Brushing up on stack pointers, frame pointers, static and dynamic links. Reference card assembly, is that all available during the exam? Yes. We are not putting you under extra pressure, worrying you about that. You can use the reference card, you can use actually the whole course material. Inside the exam, I will specify more precisely what is not allowed during the exam. In a nutshell, static contents is fine. So everything you find statically about the material is fine. Dynamic contents in terms of forums, channels, communication, obviously are not. Right? So any of those connections will get you in deep trouble if you try that. But anything else is fine. Ask more specifically if you're unsure about a specific form of support material for the exam. Good question. Are we doing screen recording, a video recording in the exam format? Yes, we do. So that's self-recorded. Not we are recording you, but you are recording yourself. And you are keeping this recording unless there is suspicion of anything, or we are asking you explicitly to show us what you have actually done during the exam. So this is self-recording for your own protection. Okay? Well, again, more details will follow that. Don't worry about the technical details here. Are the lecture recordings considered static contents? Yes. They are, even though I'm moving, the lecture recordings are considered static. But don't build on that. So you really, really don't have time to listen to lecture recordings during the exam. You should do this well before the exam, okay? As you are doing right now, so that's all fine. So that means external static material are allowed. Be careful. So if that external static material happens to be the answer to an exam question, which happens to made its way onto a static web page, that's of course not allowed. So be very careful. Don't even go anywhere near any website which could possibly contain something like that. Okay? So more details to follow here. So better don't go outside. Don't expose yourself to the risk. If you just, for example, Google any of that, there could be a possibility that one of the Google links link you to a cheat site. Right? And you're one click away from a plagiarism case in that situation. So just don't go there. Also, you're wasting a lot of time, just as a word of advice. You're wasting a hell of a lot of time in your exams if you have to Google around, if you have to look around, if you use Google Translate, if you go through external websites. Fortunately, from last year, so the handful of video recordings which we have watched and seen, students have been losing, I don't know, half their time, two-thirds of their time, senselessly looking around. Complete waste. And of course, they fail the exam because that's not solving it. That is not helping you ultimately passing the exam. So you can have the peace of mind in case of an actual emergency. You can try to find something there, but be very, very careful with it. Exam clashes with... is the exam a higher priority than other tutorials? Hell yes. Exams are definitely overriding tutorials unless the tutorials are exams themselves in some form. Then we have to negotiate. If they are standard tutorials, the exams certainly override that. You will not get a DA for having a deferred exam, for having a tutorial at the same time. You need to prioritize your exam. Sorry. If you want me to talk to the other convener, I'm happy to do so. Yep, somebody mentions that somebody has been doing lookups. Time is of the essence, even though the time provided is fairly generous for the amount of material you need to do. Keep in mind that the questions are not just tick boxes. They are not multiple choice. I said I'm not doing any of that sort because of the nature of the exam. All the exams need actual thinking, design, creation, and producing something, and that takes time. You need that time. Don't waste it by looking around. Could we know the hurdle mark statistics? I can. It's not exactly expressive, but yes, I can do that if you are interested in that. Usually, you know me, I'm publishing all kinds of stats anyway. So for all of the other assessments, your stats will definitely be published in excruciating detail. Hurdle lab I can, but it's not particularly interesting. Just to check, this is the hurdle, right? What's the hurdle? Ah, this isn't the hurdle, the mid-semester exam. No, the mid-semester exam itself isn't the hurdle. No. The exam time conflicts with my lab for this class. Should I attend another lab? Yes, of course. So we will need arrangements for you so that you have catch-up time in another lab for that week. Of course, we have to do that. Yeah. Cool. Is it redeemable? Of course not. No. Nothing is redeemable in this course. You actually have to do it. Right? And this is, the choice is very intentional. This is not mean-spirited. This is to motivate you to actually put serious effort into your mid-semester exam. You need it. Okay? And the mid-semester exam is low-weighted. So if you flunk it, you're not in hell. You can still get an HD in the course. Okay, so you don't need to have it redeemable to survive the course, but you need the motivation to actually go serious in the mid-semester exam. No, it's not redeemable. Course is pretty functional for most things computer science. Indeed. All right. So now that we got over some of your worries for the mid-semester exam and other things, let me jump right into a little bit more material about functions, and then I can do some more live coding for you about functions. So here we go. This is what you have seen, and you have coded now, right? Remember, you have, let me just remove that noise block from my right arm. Just excuse me for a sec. That annoys me a little bit. That's better. So, sorry, technical fiddling. You know how to hand over static and dynamic links, and what they're used for, and you saw how this is actually being done. Okay, so far so nice, but you can also see that there's a whole chain of links. If you have your static link here, a static link could actually link to something else, and this links to something else. So until I get to a global variable or to something which is far out of my scope, this could actually be multiple indirections. Multiple indirections are bad. Multiple indirections are slow. Right? Nobody wants to do that, besides Python programmers. But everybody else wants to have snappy access to their material. And the way how to do that is if you are living in a programming language where scope programming is kind of to be expected, and scopes, yes, can be deeper than 102, then the compiler will start putting extra measures in to make that faster. In short, it will actually provide not only the static link to the immediate environment, but it will provide all static links to all environments right away. So if you need to access a variable which is far outside, I just have a whole array of contexts, and I can select the context where I find this specific variable directly. And this is just a compiler optimization. Just for a heads up, we have not done this here in the course. A bit more work. We're not doing this manually usually. It's not the thing for assembler programmers usually. But if you write a compiler and write assembler code as part of your compiler, then you should consider doing something like that. So there's always the question of efficiency, speed. Excuse me for a second, I'm talking too much today. There's always the question of efficiency and speed. If you access parameters and if you allocate and deallocate anything. Now you saw that accessing these local variables is very snappy because they're just right there on the stack. You know the address and pop, you have them. Couldn't be any faster than that. One CPU instruction. Fine. How about allocating and deallocating? How fast can you allocate and deallocate variables on the stack? Is that a good idea? Bad idea? Allocating stuff on the stack? Slow, sluggish, complex, complicated, don't do it. Allocating things on the stack, it couldn't get any faster for a number of reasons. Allocating anything on the stack means nothing else than just moving your stack pointer. Right? If you have local variables here, the only thing you do to allocate local variables, you move your stack pointer from here to here. This is one instruction, and your local variables are allocated. Cool. Moreover, you can allocate all or a whole bunch of your local variables in one instruction. You don't need to do this variable by variable. You just say the sum of memory which I need for my variables is blah. So let's move the stack pointer by blah. And all of these variables have been allocated in one instruction. Now, sometimes you do this nevertheless in multiple stages. This depends and relies on the structure of your program, because sometimes you cannot know the size of your local variables at the very beginning of your function. And you will need to do a few calculations, and then you know, I need another buffer of this or that size. Let's allocate a local variable to that effect. So you can allocate local variables while you go, which means, depending on the structure of your program, you could do this multiple times. But still, every time you do this is one CPU instruction. How fast is the deallocation of the whole thing? The deallocation, when you move out of this function, is the same thing. You're just moving the stack pointer down over the whole range of the local variables. This is actually always done in one go, regardless whether you allocated these variables all at the same time or step by step during your function. Deallocating them is always done at the end of your function, and you can be safe to do that. It's no worry that anybody loses any access or anything like that. Local variables cannot be accessed if this function is not running, right? Because they don't exist. So your compiler will make sure nobody even tries that. And for that reason, it is A, perfectly safe to deallocate them. B, it is one assembly instruction to deallocate all of your local variables. So, no, this is highly efficient. Actually, this is as efficient as it possibly can get. And you may hope that A, you know what you're doing and you actually program in a way to tell the compiler or motivate the compiler to allocate these things on the stack. In performant programming languages, you can always actually choose that. You can put your foot down and say that this is a local variable and this goes on the stack, my friend. So you have control over that. In programming languages where you have no control over that, say Python or Java or anything like that, you just can start praying that your compiler will actually do the right thing. Okay. So we have a few questions here about this. Isn't the stack already allocated technically? Not quite sure I understand that question. Can you elaborate a little bit more on that? What you mean by that, so that I can move on to the... okay, never mind. Wouldn't make sense. Static allocated memory when machine that we allow... Okay, so I think has been answered by itself, whatever it was exactly. Good. So that should be fine. Are we clear about allocating and deallocating local variables and any other operations on the stack so far? This is just from a conceptual side at the moment. We'll do a little bit more exercise in a moment. Okay, let me progress then. So to summarize, what are we doing? This is just bit of a to-do list, and this is a bit of the maximum to-do list. So this is not what your compiler or yourself will always do if you do a function, because some of these features you may not need in a specific function. Okay, but some of them you may need. So allocate identify space for the parameters, copy the in and out parameters into that space. That's usually on the stack. Right? I'm just formulating this here a little bit more generously, because in principle there could be other architectures which are holding these variables somewhere else. Here we're assuming that they are going on the stack. Potentially provide the links. These are static and dynamic links for that one. The dynamic link is usually implicitly provided already in ARM. In other architectures you would need to do this more explicitly. In ARM you just know the previous frame pointer. In other architectures, you also have similar structures. The contextual link, the static link, is something that you need to provide always manually, because you are the only person or the compiler who can know what is the correct static link. This is not that your CPU could possibly know that. Because for that, you need to look at the structure in your higher-level programming language, which, of course, your CPU and your assembler cannot do. But you have it in your head, so you need to actually make the decision, what is the correct static link for that? That's your choice. So provide a return address also this is often done just implicitly by doing the call itself. Again, in ARM, you have somebody already explicitly storing the return address for you by the call itself, and you can then make use of this return address. Where this return address goes, whether it's just in a register or on a stack, again, this depends on the CPU architecture. But all of these things are relevant for any CPU architecture before you call a function if you need the specific features. Namely, you need parameters, you need static and dynamic links. If you don't, you can ignore all that if your function is so super simple. Also, your compiler may just generally provide all of this code in the first go, and then the optimizer comes. The optimizer says that, well, we have been nice citizens and we have been providing our static context here, but this function never actually uses the static context, so let's get rid of it. Right? So your optimizer can easily remove a lot of these things again, or maybe not even put it in the first place. Then you have the actual call, okay, obviously. What do you need to do after the call? Not much. If you have in-out parameters or return parameters, that means you need to actually now get these parameters off the stack or out of the registers so that you can actually make use of these results. Right? So the results are provided. Possibly get restore the potential frame pointer. That's in ARM done already inside the function, so you don't have to do that here in ARM architecture post-call. And restore the stack to the previous state if the stack has been used at all. Restoring the stack to the previous state usually just meaning to cut it, to remove everything which has been cluttered onto the stack for the specific function and which could be found there as return values, and then you just cut everything off. By the way, at this point here, you also see the reason why the programming language C was so tremendously popular in the late 70s, because late 70s, early 80s, because it was said to be really, really fast. Now, it was. The reason why it was really, really fast compared to most of its competitors at the time was that C does not have the concept of an actual out parameter or in-out parameter. So everything you find on the stack in a C function cannot be of return value, which means in a C function, the post call means you cut the stack. Nothing will be on the stack in a C function. And this is just uniform. This is very fast. You save all the copying back of return values because there aren't any. Now, of course, I can do this in other programming languages too by not using them. But C forbid it by its very structure, and the programmers were obviously very impressed by the tremendous speed which comes out of that. Well, they could have done this in other languages as well, but in C they have been forced to do it. That made it really fast. Now, today C is very fast, very far from the fastest programming language or the most performant programming language on the planet, unless you use it as a kind of a macro assembler. But back then it was actually beating all the competitors due to that simple feature. So, as a direct question to that, I thought that by convention when using the stack, we are meant to copy the stack contents and rewrite them back after using. But does it apply when the registers don't carry values you don't care about or use? Well, it depends what kind of parameter that is. If you have an in parameter, like for example we saw in the last lecture where we programmed this function sum over an array. Now, to make our life more interesting, last time we copied the values of this array on the stack, and then the function used the values on the stack to produce the sum. The sum was returned in a register, And when we came back from this function, I can show you this in the live coding in a second again. When we came back from this function, we didn't need the parameters anymore. So the only thing we did was to cut the stack and just dump it, throw it all away. This is exactly what a C program would have done as well. And this is what any other higher-level programming language would do as well if it is actually clear that this is an in parameter, a by-value parameter, and it does not use to return any values. Cool. Good question. I thought C is still really, really fast. yeah, that's a common notion. C is really, really fast. No, it's not anymore, because for a simple reason which you should be cheering about. Namely, compiler optimization came a long way since the 70s and 80s. And in the 70s and 80s, there was pretty much no compiler optimization, and it was just compiled as is. Hence, C was very fast because it just used it as is. But today we have compiler optimizers which are stunning. So the, for example, look at your function and remove your recursive call altogether, put this into a loop, replace all functions everywhere. Now, for these optimizers to work well, they need a lot of information. They need the information about the scopes. They need the information about, is that a constant? They need the information about, is that value potentially used somewhere else? Can I analyze the flow of my program? And more expressive languages, which means stronger typed, stronger scoped, more static, more specific languages, will make your optimizers more efficient. Right? In C, you just don't know. Everything is a reference, everything is an integer, and that's the end of the type system. Right? And you don't know any further structures, you don't know any further references or dependencies, so your optimizer goes, I don't know, this may be okay, maybe not. But in other languages, it does. So a high-performance programming language today, as you will actually see in follow-up courses, will be way more specific, and those specifics will help the optimizer to produce much more performant code. Does that make sense? All right. And, of course, lots of other languages which are very well optimized to do just what I said. C is, well, in most computer science people's books, not actually a higher-level programming language to start with. It's a kind of a universal macro assembler. And it is useful if you need to be reasonably close to assembly, programming, hacking by hand manually. But as I said, the optimizers are not really kicking in. You need to trigger that. And you cannot optimize on the machine level because it's still a higher level programming language from the perspective of instructions, so you cannot control individual ones. I mean, unless you do actual inline coding, which is basically writing assembly code. So today, you should use different programming languages if you want to do performant programming. No, that's not Python. Sorry. So, doesn't leave garbage values in registers slow down performance at all? Would it be better to ignore them or let them override over time or fill them with zeros? That's an interesting question. So we cut the stack, which means the values are still there, right? We just decide to ignore them by cutting down the stack pointer. Or we ignore what is on the return registers there. Is that... And besides the perceived messiness that we just leave some rubbish in memory around, is that a performance issue? No. It would be actually slower if you would spend extra time and extra instructions to remove that garbage and write zeros in there or something like that. You would actively need to use CPU cycles to do that. It raises, though, an interesting security question, namely if those parameters on those values are sensitive. They may have been your password or some encryption key, and leaving them on the stack so that somebody else clever can snoop into your memory and fish out this data which you declared no longer needed, but it's physically still there. That could be a security issue. And for that reason, in higher integrity programming, you actually mark sensitive data as such and actually provide deletion routines for sensitive data for that specific reason. You want to minimize the total time any kind of sensitive data lives in your main memory, because you always assume the worst, which means that somebody else has actually access to your memory while you are working, which is feasible and doable. You can learn about these things if you go into cybersecurity later. So, interesting question, and the answer is for performance, no. For sensitive values and higher integrity, potentially yes. So performance-wise, it's better to leave them, yes. And security-wise, it's better to scrub them. Yes, that's exactly what we are trying to do. For registers, it could still be a register which is just only used half an hour later. So for registers, you may also scrub them for security reasons as well. Okay. Cool. Thanks for these interesting questions. Let's get to what you do inside the function. Well, and you have already seen what we're doing that. Once you're inside the function, this is what we have called the prologue and the epilogue in our assembly programs as well so far. You save all registers which are actually needed inside the function and which are not declared scratch registers by the CPU architecture. So you're not saving R0 to R3 manually in ARM, because the general assumption is they don't survive a function call anyway. Okay. You establish a new frame pointer, what you usually do, and then you allocate space for your local variables, and that's it. Then you actually run your actual function, and by the end of it, you just need to restore your original frame pointer and get the stack back into the state which you when you saw it, when the function was actually entered. And your parameters are then hopefully also found on the stack as part of the operations here. You work on your variables and your parameters. You do this via the stack, via the frame pointer inside of that. So the parameters may have changed while you're actually operating on that. And then you return from your function as normal. So I think there is no mystery on that page for you at this time. Haven't done so many exercises on that. That should be fine, but come up with a question if there's anything unclear. Take this as a resounding no. Now, we saw that this form of scoped memory, these local variables, they will always go away after the function is completed. You cannot hold them. The stack need to be cut. We cannot just hold these variables there. They will go away. But sometimes you want to have results and values which are actually still existing after the function returns, and maybe they're so big that you don't want to push them all on the stack to be copied in and out of this function, because you, for example, just allocated a new database or allocated a gigantic picture somewhere, and you don't want to put this whole picture on the stack. This is a little clumsy. So if you have really large data structures which don't fit on the stack, and you want to have still access to them after the function returns, now what? So that's the function of, can you keep any allocations after the function returns? And this is where the so-called heap allocation comes into play. That means while this function here is running, it will actually allocate areas not on the stack, but on the heap. The heap is not automatically deallocating, So it doesn't go away after the function returns. And hence you can pass the link to this memory in heap back as a parameter to the previous function. And then the function returns. And the previous function may have copied this parameter into a local variable and has still access to this memory area, which is still living out there on the heap somewhere without doing that. That's the classical way of keeping longer-term memory. A few downsides, though. Allocating memory on the heap is a lot more CPU intensive than allocating memory on the stack. So plan for more time here, like order of magnitude or depths of magnitude, depending on the heap organization. And also be more concerned about deallocating, because it is much less clear under which circumstances you can deallocate this memory ever again. And that brings you to the question is, how can you actually get rid of this memory in the future? Some programming languages will give you garbage collection to do that, which means you have constantly some processes running in the background, looking through all of your memory, checking all of your references through your program, and trying to be clever about finding which areas are actually no longer referenced and no longer used, and then they can be disposed. As you have probably experienced in your programming languages which do that, remember your times in Haskell, for example. Haskell is very heavy on that. This very quickly and easily can accumulate 80 to 90% of your CPU time while you run a program. So if you're not very, very sensitive with that, this can be quite terrible. And some languages don't give you any choice at all. Haskell, they will allocate everything just blindly and wildly on the stack, on the heap, and spend an amazing amount of time in trying to get rid of that. So be very knowledgeable and sensitive about these kind of allocations if you have a programming language that gives you a choice, because that's a major performance limiter if you go for that. Okay. Hopefully your programming language is optimizing that out carefully and actually only using the stack, the heap, if it actually is required and needed and not just by default. Again, Python comes to mind, similar to Haskell, just blindly and wildly everything allocating there, and wildly and blindly everything garbage collecting from there, which makes it really slow. So other possibilities, smart pointers, that's the C++ way of going about that one, which gives you a more scoped idea when you can actually drop memory. That's another approach to that one. I'm not going into this programming language design any deeper. All the reference ownership strategies in languages like Rust, for example, is another approach of doing that, making garbage collection more structured, heap memory more structured in that process. Or you have scoped pointers where you say that I can already declare that this pointer is only valid in the specific scope, which means by the end of the scope, the runtime environment can automatically deallocate that area. That would be the approach in a programming language like Ada, for example. Or you have storage pools where you say that in this memory area, I'm storing images. In this storage area, I'm storing keys. This will also significantly increase the performance because you have only same-sized objects in these specific storage pools. And you can apply very different allocation, deallocation strategies depending on the data type. This is pretty advanced. So this is just foreshadowing. Heap management is a very complex topic. It is necessary for large data structures. But hopefully this shouldn't be your default for performance reasons, okay? Unless you're a Python fan. So, will you demonstrate how to allocate on the heap? No. Sorry, that's beyond the scope of this course. I'm just mentioning that your programming language or environment may have some heap allocation strategies. Well, it will have some heap allocation strategies. But this is a memory management problem, which is a whole topic in itself, how to do efficient heap memory management. In a nutshell, you need to have a memory area, which is assigned as the heap memory. Usually that's the other end of where the stack lives. And then you have an allocation and a deallocation function in that. So more C++ programmers will probably have heard of malloc. It's just that. Allocating memory in this heap area. And this gives you back a pointer into an address into this memory area, and you provide a size, how many bytes you need from the heap area before you get that pointer back. And deallocation means that you tell this heap management that this area can be labeled, tagged as available and free again, so releasing that. And depending on the sensitivity of this data, again, you can add on scrubbers so that the heap memory as well is being scrubbed when no longer needed, which is of course quite essential. All right, so sorry for not being able to actually do that. The course is not quite big enough for doing actually heap management exercises, and it's actually less of an assembly exercise. It is more of a general computer science structured data analyze and approach how to do that. And there's a reason why there's so many honors theses and PhD theses written about this topic. It's pretty big. Okay. Because everybody wants to get rid of the performance hit which you take if you do it naively. Okay. This is finalizing the conceptual part of functions so far. Before I go into our preferred assembly environment, can I get any overall questions about parameter parsing, functions? I have one question which I saw on the forums, which I will pick up in the live programming environment. All right. What's an in-out parameter? Again, an in-out parameter. That means conceptually pass by value. And in-out means that you pass a value into your function and you copy a value out of your function again. We have actually done that by filling your function. So filling the array, which we have done in the live programming exercises, means you hand over this array and it's being filled and it's being passed back. If I do this by value, meaning on the stack, that means I copy the array on the stack, hand it over, and after the function has filled the values in the array, I copy these values back from the stack into my local variable, and that's logically in-out. Not too hard, right? So, now your question is probably how does it differentiate from by reference, right? By reference means that I'm actually not copying. By reference means I'm just surrendering the address of the original data structure, which is already allocated somewhere else, and then my function works remotely on this external data structure by knowing the address of it, which can be resulting in the same effect, but has a few other downsides, which I will talk about. similar to shallow and deep copies? Yes, indeed. That's some notion, some lingo about doing this in other environments where you need to make a replicate of something and you copy it over, and whether you actually copy the values or you just produce a second copy of the address and they're still pointing to the same data, can be absolutely fatal if you do the wrong thing here. So imagine you're handing out this address to multiple functions and they're all working on the same data. That may not be logically what you want at all. This may lead to absolute chaos because you assume that there are actually two objects, and in fact there are two objects working on the same data if you have a what the student here refers to as shallow copy. Deep copy usually means you go through the whole object and you actually copy all the values into a new object. Okay, so yes, good question. What is late evaluation? Also a cool question. This is a parameter mode which is this refers to a parameter mode which is called call by name, which means instead of producing a value, I'm giving you a recipe. I'm giving you a function or an expression how to calculate this value in case you need it. Because I assume that this function takes parameter ABC, but I'm not sure whether the function always will need values for A and B and C. So what I hand over instead is I give you, if you need to actually know what the value of A is, here's how to calculate it. Right? This is call by value, which leads, call by name, let me be precise, call by name. And this leads to potentially late evaluation or no evaluation at all, because if this function decides, actually, in this specific situation, I don't care what A is anyway, I'm not actually using it, it will not evaluate as expression, which saves you potentially a lot of CPU time. Okay. We all experienced that naively when we started to do programming in lazy evaluation functions. For example, the cartoon case that you program a very, very complex function by sorting a large array, and you do this in a lazy evaluation or call by name, late evaluation programming environment, and then you call this function, and before you do that, you start a timer, and you stop the timer afterwards. And shockingly, these lazy evaluation programming languages may actually be blistering fast in doing that. And you look at why are they so much faster than anything that I've ever done in Ada or C++ or Chapel or any high-performance languages. Why are they so much faster? And then you realize that they're so much faster because they actually haven't sorted the array, because I haven't used the array afterwards. So if the programming language sees that nobody actually uses these values, so why would I calculate them in the first place, and just skips everything, just removes your whole program because you're not using it. All right, so that was just fun entertainment for late evaluation. What is passed by context? Passed by context, I probably can easier answer that in the live programming session. That means that you're actually not passing it as an explicit parameter, but you're just accessing a variable which is around you, in the context around you. Think about a variable which is declared in a function surrounding your function, or a variable which is declared in the global context of your function. You're accessing a global variable, you're accessing a local variable in your surrounding. You can access this variable, and this is in that context, what we probably have called pass by context. So you have to hand over what the context actually is, and then all everything which is declared in that context is instantly available to this inside function. Without passing the value or the address of the variable itself, you're just passing where this whole context, all of these variables out there, live as the context. We have also done that in live programming. The stack mechanism is similar to pushdown automata in function. Sort of, yes. Yes, I don't want to be too specific in here because I'm not quite sure what you specifically mean by that. So a pushdown automata has a few more features than just the function and the stack. But there's obviously some relation there, I'd say. So, some upvoted question. Are there any registers stored static and dynamic links? Okay. Anybody minds answering that? So, let's be specific about the ARM architecture in that context. In general, that could be anything, but in the specific ARM context, the dynamic link is usually provided by the previous frame pointer. So if I maintain my frame pointers while I'm going around and I call a new function, the frame pointer which has C when entering a new function is my previous frame pointer, so that's the dynamic link. The static link need to be provided manually, and the static link usually is provided via the stack, but in theory I can also do this via register if you prefer to do so. Okay. But it's not done, the static link is not done automatically for you. Neither is the dynamic link in that sense. It's just by convention that the frame pointer is still set to something sensible when you actually enter the function. Okay. That seems could be pretty useful for concurrency optimization. Yes, very much so. Once we go into concurrency, the game will change again completely, because you need to be aware that not only you're handing out addresses to some functions which do something for you, but these functions could all run at the same time. And if you have this in mind, in an actual concurrent environment, which is pretty much everything today, besides the CPU on your board, if you buy anything which is $2 more expensive, then you will get multi-core environments and the world will turn concurrent straight away. I mean, in many ways, your board is already highly concurrent because you already have multiple CPUs in there, and the devices are also concurrent to your CPU, which are on the chip. So you already have a lot of concurrency, but not in the classical multi-core sense. The classical multi-core sense you will do in the next course. So yes, this is all very useful, and keep in mind if you want to understand how to program well in a concurrent environment and super safe and clean in a concurrent environment, you definitely need to have understood everything that we are saying here. Indeed. So do we cover how to pass by name in the lecture? No. We did cover that, yes. I did go through that, but I'm not doing live programming for that. Let me put it like that. This is too dependent on a specific higher level programming language, how you hand over an expression. So you need to have a convention how to hand over an expression. And there is no universal notion of that. That just depends what you're programming in. But definitely we have mentioned call by name in the lecture before. Excellent. So let me look a little bit more into, where are we here? Into scoped programming, into programming with different parameter modes. A little reminder. It seems that by, the question just pops up as the last question I'm picking up here. It seems that by context is similar to by reference. Yes and no. So it is it is a different form of making this reference available, I'd say. So it is also, in both cases, you're not copying values. In both cases, you're just making it accessible via the address of this variable. In by reference, you're explicitly giving the address of this variable. In by context, you're giving the address of the context where this variable is in, and then you need another step of indirection to address the actual variable from your context. So yes, there's certainly a relation there. It's not the same, okay? But good question, like that. So another question which I have gotten now multiple times, and I think we should address that for all. Can one function has multiple different modes of parameter passing? Any idea? Can we have a whole bunch of different modes of parameter passing in one function? And yes, of course, the answer is a resounding yes. As a matter of fact, you're looking at it because what do you have here? You have pass by value, maybe by reference, depending how we decide to implement that. And we have by return. So you already have by value, by return. If you look at the functions which we have done later in the last programming session, let me go to this one here, for example. No, not this one. Let me go to this one. Sum it all, sum it by value on the stack. Now you're handing over the array by value on the stack, and you have a by value return parameter on the return register. Right? So all of these functions, is actually pretty hard to write a function which has exactly one mode of parameter for the simple reason that you have things going in and out, and they're usually not on the same channel. Besides, you have a pure by reference function without a return value. Right? That would be an example for a single parameter mode operation. That would not actually be a function because it doesn't return anything. So it would be a subroutine or a procedure which has only a by reference operation, which is actually a little rare. Right? So most of your functions will have multiple parameter modes without any issues. Okay. So going through the programs from last time. So we have the scope functions here, and I think you understood how we do by context here. Let me be a bit mean. Now, assuming that these functions are not just calling each other once, but assume for a second that these functions are actually recursive functions. If I hand over the context of a recursive function, which value are you actually accessing by context if the outside function has been calling itself, or you have been calling the outside function multiple times? Which of the outside values are you accessing by context in that case? You understand what I mean? So here we have exactly one instance of X, Y, and Z on the screen, but functions can be recursive. So if functions are recursive, as we have seen in the Fibonacci examples, for example, then you have many instances of these parameter values, and of course they can also be part of the context for another function. So every time I access that context, which of the local variables will I get my hands on? The very first one, the latest one, one somewhere randomly in the middle, all of them? Think about it. Let me answer another question while you think about this. For array on stack, the element with the lowest address is the first element or the last element, or do we need to define this ourselves? This is to be defined yourself. There is no standard in which order that goes on the stack, first or last element. There's also no standard about the enumeration or indexing for this whole thing. How you arrange your data structures is completely up to you, and you will later on need to make lots of these decisions. In an array, you can still start wishing for, tell me how to do it, but in a record, for example, different programming languages or structure, in how you call it in more C programming language environments, there are many different ways how to do that. Some compilers and some languages are more restrictive and more explicit how this is supposed to be structured. Others gives you lots of choice how to do that. C, for example, doesn't actually give you any kind of information how to allocate that properly. And hence, that could lead to quite some confusion if you mix different C compilers which are not having the same understanding of filling your data in a specific type. So you need to, the answer is you need to define this basically yourself. Can you be more specific? More specific about what? I always can be more specific. So the answer is yes. If you tell me what I'm supposed to be specific about, the question about the array, how to, whether the first element or the last element is on the supposed to be on the stack. I think I was specific in that question by saying it's your job. Nope, on the screen. Can I be more specific on the screen? Can I be more specific on the screen? I don't know. I could. What do you want me to be more specific about? So the question which I had is, assume these functions B and C are actually recursive functions. They're called many times. Maybe A is also a recursive function. So when looking at this value X, with A being a recursive function, which means there are many instances of function X around, which value X will I actually gain if I access X from here? Ah, yeah, okay. So I think I'm getting there then. Okay. Will that be the original value x when a was called for the first time? Will that be the value x when x was called for the last time? Okay, we have two guesses for the latest one. Latest is calling it recursively is dynamic. Mm-hmm. Okay. I think they're all fair guesses, yeah? And they're actually all correct. If you access a variable in context, it is the latest instance of this variable which you get your hands on. Now, this is conceptually actually a little tricky to get your head around that properly, so hence I'm asking that specifically. What you look at in the context is you get the context of the latest instance of this function, if there are multiple instances of this function. Okay. And this is actually what you expect. If you write real programs to that effect, this is what you actually want to have. Good. So, but that's a bit of a more interesting question, which gets you a bit further into understanding by context. If you get your head around that, you got it all. Then there is no further mystery about calling by context. So that was the calling by context thing. Then we filled out the array on the stack by reference. We handed over a pointer explicitly to this array and then filled it out. Then we wrote a function which assumes that all the values are actually lying on the stack. And we got the size of the array over the parameters. What I can do to make it actually a bit more interesting, because mostly arrays, if they're a little bigger, will probably no longer passed over on the stack, but I would assume that arrays will actually be passed over by only passing the reference to the outside world, right? And that's probably something that we should briefly do, that we find out how to actually sum up the values inside an array by only handing over the reference to the whole thing. Okay, let me just get to... This is what we needed to understand passing the actual value. So we have an actual array, which could be any kind of an actual array, which could be any kind of size. Sorry, let me mark that so you can see what I'm talking about. Which could be any kind of size. The size has been given by the register. The values have been found on the stack. And now we are trying to do something which is, for concurrent programming, a little bit more risky, but could be more efficient if you have a larger array, namely passing it by reference. If you want to do it by reference, the data structure around that probably looks a little different. Let me give you something like that. Then the data structure will again be, there will be an array of integers somewhere, but I need to have an understanding of an actual pointer to that. I have the address of this array. I need to have a type which can express the address of that array. And now instead of the values itself, I have as an in parameter the pointer to the whole thing. Okay? And I still have a call by return, by value return, in my register. Everything else is similar. Size of the array is still passed in the register, but the address itself is now to be stored on the stack. Okay, that's the other interesting case which you may be wanting to see in actual programming. Okay, let me just try to get this done for you. So that's the sum which we will call, we had by value return, now we have in by reference on the stack or in registers. Let's make it on the stack to make it more interesting. I still have a choice where I pass that, but in that case, let's try to do this on the stack. On registers is a little too boring at the moment. Let's do it on the stack. On registers, I'm sure when you have seen that one, you can do it by register as well fairly easily. So, and we usually have the store multiple with decrement, as we always do, on a stack pointer with our previous frame pointer and the link register done. We are making a little bit of, we are providing a new frame pointer, of course. The new frame pointer is the current stack pointer offset by 4 because we only have 2 registers on the whole thing. And that's our usual prologue. So. This is just mechanical, not doing anything there. So let's find the address of the register, and we are assuming that the register would be found on the stack there. Frame pointer, and again, frame pointer plus 4, right? Frame pointer plus 4, that will be our parameter address on the stack. Okay. As a reminder again, frame pointer minus something is my local definitions, my local variables, which I have inside my function. Frame pointer plus something, which means I point into the stack, means I address the parameters which are actually part of the previous frame in that sense. So then the rest is actually pretty much identical to what we have done before. We're calculating the end address of the whole thing. And we do this by having a logical shift left by 2 of R1, which is the size of our array, and adding this to the base address, which gives me the address back. Then we need to nominate a register which gives me the end result of the whole thing. I initialize that just by 0. And I need another label to jump back to that one. This is the sum loop for the case in by reference on stack. Okay. Loading the register again from the address which I still have in R2. R2 moves slowly through my array. So as I say this moving here, I'm loading the first array element and immediately incrementing R2 by 4 to make it already point on the next element. Adding whatever I got there to my accumulating register R0. I check whether R2 is already at R3, and if this is still less than R3, then I have to jump back, which means I have my sum loop in by reference. Picked the wrong one. Let me just copy the whole thing. Don't want to do a typo here. And I'm done, mostly. Of course, I have to get everything back from the stack again, because now I have my return value already neatly in R0. And I restore previous frame pointer and previous link register so that I can actually jump back nicely. And I say get back from this function. Nice, that was not too hard. So can I actually call this function? If I have now this function by reference on stack, what do I need to assume what this function looks like so that I can actually call it? I call this function here already. Let me call this other function as well, see whether it returns the same result. How do I call a function like this? Now, as they are actually expecting the address of this array on the stack, I better put it on the stack. How do I do that? Well, store. R5 is still the nominated register, which is still holding our global variable. And I put it on the stack. And again, putting things on the stack means I use the stack pointer by first decrementing it by minus 4 and write it also back so that the stack pointer moves in the process. this is my operation of pushing the address of the array. Cool. Don't forget that we actually have to provide the size of the array, because our function here works on any sized array, so we have to tell them how big the array is. And then we can call our sum, not the loop, I made that wrong last time, sum by reference on stack, and I cut the stack afterwards. Add stack pointer 4. So, questions about this. The question is apparently to the actual sum by reference on stack. If I look at R1, does it mean you override R1 with the values from the array? By the end of the function, there is no longer the length of the array stored in R1. That's correct. I have done implicitly this optimization here. Of course, I could use another register, but that would mean that I'm probably starting to run out of registers, and I would need to use R4. Now, the moment I use R4, anything higher than that, that means I need to actually save that, and that makes me slower. So I'm trying to get away with as much as possible by just using R0 to R3 without accidentally overriding something which I still would have needed. And R1, I only need once, I only need it here to calculate the end address. After that, I don't have any need to know what the size of array anymore is, because I translated this into another form. I now know what the end address, so my end address is here. I now know what the end address is, and I use that here to stop the loop, and I don't need the number anymore. So, good question. Wait, these two functions are the same as sum by value. Yes. So, we did not want to actually write a different function. We want to write a function which uses a different parameter mode, so that you can compare them side by side and see exactly where the differences are. The differences are actually fairly minor. If you compare these two functions now, this is, keep that line here. We loaded the start address of the array, and we found the start address of the array as a parameter on the stack. Cool. Now let's have a look what we have done on Monday. This was here. We found the start address of our array on the stack as the value. So the frame pointer plus 4 is actually the start address of this array, because this array is on the stack. The frame pointer plus 4 indirect is not the value, is the address of the whole thing, and I'm now loading the address by indirecting that, hence I need the square brackets here. So very small difference, but big difference in effect, because now I'm actually working on the outside global variable directly. It's a totally different experience watching you code and code myself. Possibly. But trust me, I'm doing lots and lots of mistakes myself if it's actually getting a little bit more complicated. That's just something which, once you have the concepts very straight in your head, you will actually know which form of indirection you need. And I do understand very well that that takes exercise and takes practice. My recommendation is, don't get too fixated on the assembly code itself. Don't stare too much on it. If you don't have these colorful diagrams and the overarching concepts in your head while you're doing that, you have a pretty hard time. So you need to be able to go back and forth between the abstraction and the actual assembly programming. And once your assembly programming starts blurring in front of you and everything looks the same, then just close your editor for a moment and stare at the colorful diagrams again a little bit. Try to get your head around the abstract modes again before you go into that one. And draw diagrams. Take out a piece of paper, draw a stack frame, very, very valuable. Draw a stack frame and start putting nice pointers, literally, onto these diagrams so that you can understand what is actually there, what is actually referenced, what is just a pointer and address around that one. It's so much easier for humans to actually draw that as opposed to just imagining that in front of their mental eyes. Okay. Do you want me to be brave enough to try whether this actually compiles? Oui, it does. Okay, so if it actually compiles, can I actually run that? Do I want to run that? Let me see whether anything actually works there. So, probably need to have a new breakpoint because I'm at the very start of my main program. I stopped it here last time, and let me stop it now here as well so that we can see that the function actually works. That was just the first call to our A from last time, which is supposed to return 4. It does. That was the call the fill routine. Nothing really happened there. Then call by value on the stack, and the return value now has to be 1023 because we have 1 plus 2 plus 4 plus 8, etc., which with 10 values will give you a sum of 1023. Now comes the worrying part, our new function. Stops here and also returns 1023. Okay, that seems to be actually working. And the effort to call this function by value on the stack, you see, is a little bit more because I actually have to copy them on the stack. But my global variable or my local variable here in main is now free, and I don't have to worry that anybody is manipulating my values in this area anymore because it has its own copy to play with. Not that it makes a difference here in this specific case, but you understand the general notion that this may be more or less dangerous. Cool. Okay, I think that sort of worked. I like that. So I would like to wrap up with this lecture here the notion of functions, not your usage of functions, because you will use, hopefully, functions from here on out and the rest of your life, and hopefully have used gazillions of functions in your programming languages so far, and you will also now develop the habit of using them in your assembly coding directly. You will find out that your programs all of a sudden become so much more structured and beautiful if you get your head around that. Okay? Quiz questions from last Wednesday. Sure, I can dig them up. That's not a problem. Modularity. Or information hiding, right? Of course, keep your things nicely, your concerns nicely separated in your programs. Don't make a jump wildly about spaghetti code system. So individual branches should be very, very local. So if you don't see on your screen where your branch, your direct local branch goes to, you probably made a mistake in the structure of your program. Your branches should only be far away if you actually call a function. So the branch and link, the BLs, they can be far away. Everything else, for example, here the branch less or equal in our loops, what we have done, they should be very local little loops, right? Everything else should not be branching any further away, because that's not modularity, as you nicely put it there. Cool. Enjoy your labs and give me a little bit of time actually writing your mid-semester exam. Keep being active on the forums, and I will keep you posted about the format and more details about the mid-semester exam as well. Could we include the Q&A screen on the video lecture video? Unfortunately not. That's not something I can easily embed there. Sorry for that. So that's more live. But I do have the habit of actually reading out the questions in the lecture itself. So you actually, even if you listen to that afterwards, you will still know what question I'm answering, because I'm reading them out. Cool. Thanks, everybody. I think that was fun, and enjoy your function programming. Have a happy rest of the day. Cheers.